Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. I have Mateen filling in for Qasim today, and our guest today is Alex. So Alex, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself? Tell us where you live and what you do for a living.
Certainly. My name is Alex Blum. I am a Houston native. I now live in Austin, Texas, where I've lived for about 16 years. I am an entrepreneur, philanthropist, activist, and humanitarian. Credits and roles include about 10 years in sales. I have executive produced, narrated, and written a documentary on the Rohingya genocide. And I currently lead multiple foundations as well as a private company. Those foundations are the Blum Family Foundation, which provides educational resources to young Muslim women in refugee camps, a project called Project Icarus, which is currently working on legislation dealing with online extremism. And lastly, actually inactively, I work with and founded Protecting Texas Families, which is a nonprofit dedicated to reducing gun violence in Texas. And lastly, I currently lead Applied Bioplastics as its CEO. Applied Bioplastics is a company that makes decarbonized plastic feedstock for manufacturers. It costs less than the plastic that they use today and reduces the carbon emissions by up to 85%, as well as microplastics by up to 85%. And like I said, it's cheaper. It's also made and used in the same industry standard equipment. So it's really easy for plastic companies to adopt this technology that we've invented. The other thing we do is we use the same type of bioplastic technology to construct housing, climate resilient, weather resilient, fire resilient, and very inexpensive locally produced housing for refugees all over the world. We just received our first purchase order from the United Nations 2 weeks ago. We have been operating a small refugee camp within the world's largest refugee camp for the last 3 years. The data shows that our shelters have reduced disease by 80%, as well as home invasion, rape, and theft by 100% over 2 years. So that's me. I'm Alex Blum. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So I just want to say, how do you manage your time that you do all these things? That's amazing. You do all this great work running a company. And how are you able to manage your time day to day?
You know, time management is the struggle of every entrepreneur. There was a time at which I was working 18-hour days for multiple years straight. At this point, actually, I became sick during our founding of this company, and my sickness has since disabled me. So I frequently have to use a cane or a wheelchair. I'm currently wearing two leg braces as we speak. So I have an autoimmune disorder that is eating the bones in my legs. And the interesting thing about this is it's forced me to prioritize my time differently. I don't have the energy to do a lot of the things that I used to do. So I have to prioritize fitness. I have to prioritize my personal relationships, eating good food and not just what's convenient, which is tough when you're an entrepreneur. You're running around from meeting to meeting and stuff like that. But I think a recalibration of what you really want to accomplish is the first step to being able to manage your time in an efficient way. What really matters? And what is it that you personally need to do as the entrepreneur versus what can your staff do? Right. So learning how to delegate as a leader is a really big deal. And learning to kind of let go. Because, you know, I think the average entrepreneur thinks that they are the best person to do every job. Right. And that's just not true. You have to trust your team. So being able to trust your team, being able to prioritize what truly needs you to do it enables you to kind of chisel down on the amount of hours that you're spending every day doing everything. So I'll give you an example of an average week. I work about 20 to 30 hours per week on Applied Bioplastics. We have 25 employees. We've been around for 5 years. We're just getting to revenue. You'd think I'd be running around with my hair on fire, but I have learned to trust my team. I've learned to delegate. And so I can get away with 20 to 30 hours, which leaves me time for the other projects that I've mentioned.
Awesome. So can you talk more about Applied BioPlexis? How did you get the idea to start this company?
Certainly. So the idea here came from actually coincidence. I like to say that I fell kind of ass backwards into being an entrepreneur. So I'll tell you the origin story because I think that demonstrates who I am, but also answers your questions. So I did corporate sales, corporate technology sales for nearly 10 years. I worked for Amazon, for Oracle, all here in Austin. I did a startup called WP Engine, which is headquartered on, you know, down on in downtown. And lastly, I worked for Thousand Eyes, which was acquired by Cisco for a little over $2 billion a few summers ago. Now, Thousand Eyes was an enterprise network monitoring company. Great, great product. Really loved it, and was good at selling it. It paid for itself pretty easily. So that's something that a salesman always loves. So I, you know, in 2017, I had recently been divorced. I then closed the biggest deal of my entire life and ended up with a $500,000 paycheck. Now, I was 27, I was debt-free, and looking at real estate prices in Austin, I probably should have bought a house, but instead I decided I'm going to give $500,000 away to charity. You know, I grew up as kind of a gutter punk. I was always very poor, you know, after leaving the house, you know, doing the odd job sort of thing, never really had a lot of direction in my early 20s. And so, you know, I've never felt comfortable with large amounts of money. So I said, you know what, I got to get rid of this. So I decided to dedicate it to charity. That's how I ended up starting Protecting Texas Families, which got 100 elected Republicans to agree to a gun law, you know, basically by me walking from my office on 7th Street up to the Capitol every day for 3 months and knocking on doors. You know, consummate salesman here. But you know, I did that. I got involved a little bit in the protest space as well as and I'd been doing that for many years, but you know, leaned into that a little bit. And then I heard in late 2017 about the beginnings of the Rohingya genocide in Myanmar. A friend of mine actually lived in Bangladesh where the refugees were fleeing to, and said something really horrible is happening. I don't know what, but 2 million people just crossed the border. And I said, that's horrible. Now, I am of Jewish descent. I don't know if you can tell from the curly hair and the big nose, but, you know, the world promised in 1949, never again. And we have failed that promise repeatedly. There have been many genocides since the Holocaust. And I said, this is messed up. And what's even more messed up is that nobody's paying attention to this problem. So I flew out there to Bangladesh to go see what I could do to help with what money I had left that I had earmarked for donating, which was about a quarter of $1 million. I arrived about 9 months before Angelina Jolie showed up. I was the first American with boots on the ground in the situation. And I realized it was far beyond any sort of scope that I could personally help with. You know, I had $250,000. There were 2.5 million refugees. What am I going to do? Hand everybody a dime and say, good luck, you know? So that wasn't going to work. So I decided there had to be something else I could do to help these people. And I realized that it was surprising to me that a whole genocide was going completely unnoticed by the international media. So I said, there's got to be a way to fix that part, right? Maybe I can get these people some help if I can get some more attention to what's happening to them. So I hired a crew, mostly Bangladeshis, one Nepali, one Indian guy. And we, you know, in 3 weeks got into the world's largest refugee camp, shot a film, crossed the border illegally into Myanmar, got shot at, gathered direct evidence of the crimes against humanity there. We submitted that evidence to the International Criminal Court at The Hague, which they actually used to hold the leaders of Myanmar accountable. We showed the film to the late Senator John McCain, who wrote the Burma Human Rights and Freedom Act as a package of sanctions against Myanmar to stop the killing. And lastly, the film won Best Short Documentary in London, the World Fest International in Houston, and was acquired by Amazon. So just knocked it out of the park, right? So while I was there, I was introduced to a Bangladeshi scientist. His name was Dr. Mubarak Khan. Now, Dr. Khan used to be a nuclear physicist. He set up the first nuclear reactor in Bangladesh and had retired since and had been working on ways to make Bangladesh a richer place. So, you know, Bangladesh used to be a British colony. When it was a British colony, it used to sell this cloth made out of a plant they grow called jute. Jute is good for sackcloth, rope, sails. You can see why it would be important to the British on the opposite side of the world, right? So when they decolonized, this was their main export. Now, nylon got invented about 20 years later and just destroyed the market for jute. So Dr. Khan was looking for ways to make jute more useful in order to, you know, bring his country up, and was, you know, working on that in his little lab. So he showed me some of his inventions. And one of them was the housing system that we have commercialized at this point. And I was just like, this is amazing. It's $1 a square foot. It can be produced by hand, which is great for building local economies and things like that. And, you know, nearly fireproof, super weatherproof, heavy, great insulation. Like it's a fabulous building material. And I asked him, where is this deployed? Cause this is such a great idea. And he says, well, nowhere. And I said, well, yeah, how long have you had it? And he said, about 20 years. And I was just like, what's wrong with you, man? You know? And he's like, well, I'm a chemist, not a salesman. I said, well, I'm a salesman, not a chemist. So why don't we partner up and make this thing real? So we did. And that was 2018. And I ended up acquiring the patent for that building material from him. So originally we were a refugee housing company. It was pointed out to me about a year later by a couple of scientists, you know, if you converted this housing into a bioplastic for manufacturers, you could make billions of dollars. And I was just like, I like the idea of billions of dollars, not because I want them, but because I could use them to help more people. And so we started exploring that. And yeah, we filed our patent on it about 2.5 years ago. So yeah, we're on our way. We have a $1.3 billion sales pipeline at this point. We have just gotten to post revenue with both of our products. And we're starting to deploy out to multiple countries with those refugee shelters. So that's how it happened.
Awesome. So are you using that material only for refugee shelters, or is it being used for other types of industries? Like, who is your target customer?
So right now it's NGOs and governments. And the reason is that this stuff can be made in situ on site when a disaster strikes. It can also be made in advance. So we were actually invited to speak at the United Nations General Assembly in May. And as a result, 27 nations, most of them Caribbean nations, are really interested in building this stuff ahead of time and then deploying it out after a hurricane hits so as to prevent excess death, right? So like, you know, people just need roofs over their heads in a disaster situation. It helps so many aspects of it. So that's the thing there. And then, you know, we're actually making a hire. I don't want to say her name yet because she hasn't said yes yet, but we're hiring a new director of product for Betterboard, which is the refugee housing system. We recently learned that it has an R value of 30 while still only being 3 millimeters thick. And that R value is insulation, right? So that is insanely high. It's really, really high. And that revealed to us when we tested that, that this was commercially viable too. So the reason we're making this hire is so that we can bring somebody in to model out and begin to commercialize the Betterboard in the traditional building, both commercial and residential industry. So big, long hill to climb on that. Building materials are a very kind of a gated community. There's a lot of regulation. There's a lot of certification. There's a lot of, you know, tire kicking. But yeah, we are headed in that direction to commercialize Betterboard as a more standard building material and not just a transitional refugee housing system.
Makes sense. So obviously now in technology is the role of AI, right? AI is like everything. So are you using AI in your business? And if so, what is the use case for it?
So we've considered it. We're a little bit under-resourced as it stands today. So, you know, we don't really have the money to go and build something custom right now. Now, do we use ChatGPT to, you know, write copy and then, you know, have a human edit it? Of course we do. But that's because it's free, right? Now, we did speak with a leading AI professor over at the University of Connecticut about 6 months ago, who indicated to us that should we be able to build our own data set of polymer formulations, it would be possible to create an AI model that could develop formulations for specific use cases faster for us. But at the same time, you know, this is material science. It's you know, what works in a computer may not work in the physical world. So, you know, we need to do two things. The first one is set up our rapid prototyping facility in India. Currently, we only have an additive mixing facility. We're currently in the middle of a raise, raising $5 million, already have $1 million committed. But the purpose of this raise is to build that rapid prototyping facility so that we can create new versions of polymers faster. Right now, I have 14 grades of plastic. I need 200,000 grades of plastic to address the market segment that I want to address. So we need to do that faster. One option, like I said, is AI creating those formulations. But then the problem is you have to test them. So what I'm doing is I'm going for the testing equipment first and hiring scientists who can come up with those formulations. Maybe one day we'll adopt a, we'll create the data set and adopt an AI that can help us speed up our formulation process, but not yet.
Makes sense. So in terms of your customers, you mentioned that it's different countries, but do you have, you know, for example, certain states here in the U.S. might have natural disasters. Would they be buying your product too? Or what does that look like?
You know, it's kind of funny that you asked that because I, you know, one of the first groups that I approached with this refugee housing system was FEMA. And word for word, I was told Americans don't want to live in shacks. And, you know, I get it. These are not houses. They are, shack is probably an unkind way to put it, but, you know, they look like this. It's about, 1,000 square feet for a family of four. It's not a house, but it's a heck of a lot better than a tent, right?
Right.
And it's a lot safer than a tent. But, you know, what I said to the FEMA rep was, you know, I understand your position. You're going to call me in about 10 years when Florida's underwater, right?
Exactly, yep.
You know, I expect that we will make some traction with the U.S. federal government on a number of things. They have a program called BioPreferred, which requires federal contractors to purchase materials that have U.S.-based biomaterial in them. Now, barely anyone's ever taken advantage of this program because there just aren't really cheap biomaterials on the market, except until now, right? So nobody's made those purchases. And so I see us helping build military bases, on-base housing, other things like that with both of our systems in the near future. However, I think it's going to take a little bit more doing to get organizations like FEMA to see the value. I think for now we've got a big fleet of FEMA trailers. They're good for emergencies up to like 20 million people who need to be rehoused. But when it goes above that number, the question is how quickly can we pump those out? And is it possible that, you know, we're going to need some additional transitionary housing? I think the answer is yes. I'm not betting the farm on it, but FEMA, my phone is open. Call me.
So do you think that like in the U.S., it's just more difficult to get approval for things? I feel like, you know, I hear this, you know, things take longer, that there's, you know, just, you know, so much more red tape per se to get them to, you know, like adopt to something new.
You know, I think I would actually disagree with that. You know, the place that we started this company is Bangladesh, right? And given right. that it is a quasi-democracy, but in reality is more of a totalitarian state, nationalization could occur to any business at any time in that country. The regulations are extremely strict and stringent. We've had to hire an additional legal team to help us understand the, frankly, Byzantine laws of this developing nation. Same thing goes for India, although India, I would say, is much more business friendly. So Bangladesh, though, is like in the top five of the toughest places on earth to run a business. So I'm not scared by the U.S. government's federal, you know, red tape and stuff like that, or the bureaucracy. Hey, at least they don't take bribes. At least there's a documented way to get the stuff done in the U.S. That's not true in other countries, right? Like, not to say that we've done anything illegal, but I got to tell you, we've been offered so many times. You're like, hey, if you want to speed up this administrative process, meow, meow, meow. You know, and like, we're like, we have FARCA in the United States, which is a federal law essentially saying that I get to go to big boy prison if I, you know, engage in corruption in foreign countries. So that does make things a lot slower in countries where corruption is endemic. And so again, in the US, everything's well documented. It may take a long time and there may be a lot of red tape, but at least there's no, you know, hey, skip the line. And if you don't try to skip the line by bribing me, then I'm going to put you at the bottom of the pile, right? Like the U.S. federal government will get to you eventually, you know, at some point, right? So I would say that it's not awesome, but between both the Obama and the Trump and the Biden administrations, I think that we, you know, I don't agree with any of those politicians, but their economies have been rather business friendly.
Right. So I have to ask, our team is mostly in Pakistan. So do you work with people in Pakistan as well?
We're working on it. So, you know, one of the things that's interesting about, you know, the film that I made is that I am considered by the Chinese federal government an international terrorist, because my film enlightened people to the fact that China was actually helping pay for this genocide in Myanmar in order to build an oil pipeline through that land that they were clearing out of those people. I cannot travel to countries that have a close relationship with China, because I will be extradited to China to face justice for my crimes. So it's tough. So we can't go directly to Pakistan because they do have rather close relationships with the Chinese. That being said, however, we are working directly with the UN. They are taking our housing solution to Nepal first, but Pakistan, with the the flooding that has occurred recently and will reoccur, is a big target for us as far as helping those people. So we're not there yet. Also on that list, at the same level of priority, is Turkey and Syria, with the major earthquakes that they've been experiencing, as well as the corruption in the construction industry, which created so many more deaths in that recent earthquake. We want to go help those people as well. It's just going slower than we'd like, because again, we're dealing with governments. These things take some time.
Makes sense. So what would you say is the biggest challenge that you're facing right now in your business?
I think it's money. We have a really profitable business model. We just achieved our first recurring sale in India, the most price sensitive market on earth, and made a profit on that first sale. Not many startups can say that. We're really proud of what we've done so far. The issue is that most investors don't know how to invest in a company like ours. Most investors are used to software as a service, which means we can talk about monthly active users and, recurring revenue due to annual contracts and, other things like that. And frankly, plastic isn't bought like that. Plastic is purchased on spot price. So you might get the sale this month, but you may not get the sale next month. So it's tough to prove recurring revenue. It's tough to prove the reality of our pipeline. So like, essentially, if I had a bunch more resources right now, I could activate all $1.3 billion of my pipeline today, right? Like, I could start closing deals today. And by this time next year, I'd have all $1.3 billion in revenue. The problem is that I'm told by investors, well, I need to see you close more of that pipeline before I can invest. And I'm saying, I need your money to close more of that pipeline. So it's kind of a chicken and the egg problem that's very frustrating for us. We've nearly run out of money four times in the history in 5 years, not because of mismanagement. We don't have a fancy office. In fact, we all work from home. We've got a minimal lab capacity in India. We have a bunch of partners that we use to save money. Most of our employees live in developing nations, which means that despite being paid extremely generously, their contribution to the burn rate is very low, right? So we're lean, we're mean, we're succeeding, but we're having a hard time getting investors to understand our business model, which is a licensing model. And we're also having trouble getting investors to understand why we do things the way we do things. Like, for instance, we have turned down over $350 million in opportunities in the last 5 years. And those opportunities are single-use plastics and defense items. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I was a very, very good salesman when I was doing sales. My last year in sales, I was supposed to make $200,000. I made $1.4 million that year. So if this was about money, I would have taken those deals. Or I wouldn't have started the company in the first place and just made $1.5 million a year doing sales, right? But I don't want my technologies to help turn Palestinian kids or Pakistani kids or any other conflict area in the world into corpses, right? Like, I started this company to help people, not to make more people homeless, not to make more people dead. So we've turned down every single defense-related opportunity that we've been given. We've also turned down every single single-use plastic opportunity that we've been given, because there's a great number of single-use bioplastic companies out there. They make biodegradables, they make water solubles, they make lots of things like that. And I want customers to go to them, because what my stuff does is durable plastics. We're talking toys, tools, technology, transportation, car parts, airplane parts, home goods. I mean, things that last for a while. That's the kind of plastic we make. And if you put our plastic into a single-use application, you're betraying the value proposition. We're not that much better if you're going to throw it away in seconds after using it. We're not that much better than petroleum-based plastic. Our value comes in when the plastic is used for more than 6 months. It sequesters carbon for longer, right? So we turn down those opportunities because it's morally wrong to take them, right? So that's kind of where we're at.
Makes sense. So what would you say is the one biggest piece of advice that you wish you knew before you started this company?
Biggest piece of advice? That's really tough. I think that I would have wanted to do more internal development on the pitch and honestly, just being a first-time founder is really tough. So if this could have been my second business and had gone through all the trials and travails and failures, it would have been a lot easier to do it this time around. Like, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, man, if I started this over today, I would have fixed so many things. To start out with, here's a stupid anecdote of a first-time founder mistake. So COVID hits, right? And we have to lock everything down. We don't have facilities. We've got guys sitting in their homes costing us money. And so what we tried to do, we're like, well, we can't really work on our core product. So let's work on importing N95 masks to the United States so that we can still be of help and maybe also make some money. We spent thousands of dollars signing up for the SAM registry. We spent hundreds of hours pitching municipalities, hospitals, other things like that. We spent, thousands of dollars securing shipments of N95 masks. We never made a sale after 6 months of pursuing this because we couldn't, we weren't imaginative enough to come up with a way to keep working on our core product while everyone was stuck at home. So that distraction cost us 6 months. And I think we've had a couple other distractions like that. So I think if I was to boil that down, I'd say, make it your second company. And if you can't do that, avoid distraction, keep your nose to the grindstone on your main product. It'll save you money in the long run.
Makes sense. So if somebody watching this wanted to reach out to you, do you mind sharing your website or just best way to get in contact with you?
Sure. So my personal site where I keep all of my interviews, which I'm sure this is going to go up on at some point, and all of my media coverage, as well as my contact info and all of the projects that I'm working on, is consequential.co. We only work on consequential stuff. The other websites you can visit are, my LinkedIn. You can message me there, linkedin.com/AlexAppliedBio. Or our main website, which is www.appliedbioplastics.com.
Awesome. Well, Alex, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. We're rooting for you. Hopefully you guys can raise more money and help more people.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Alex. All right. Okay. Bye.